So I went through an interesting 12-step meeting last week. That was just when you say interesting 12-step meeting, it's already unusual because most of them are like 1950s commercial. You know, I started to use Fab, and now my clothes are clean, and I can get a good husband, and I'll never be sad again. It's the same thing with I stopped drinking, and all my problems went away. Anyway, so, but this was a good one because people were talking about how they were facing some catastrophes, calamities in life, divorces, sudden job losses, parents getting sick, all these kind of the real challenges in life. And I thought I'd give a talk about using our practice, not just for reducing stress in our lives right now, but also the way it plays a role in what I'll call preparing for calamities. And calamities is a word that nobody uses, so I'm going to use it because it's gone out of favor. I don't know why. Very nice word to say. Life crises. Emergency preparations. So, the Buddha said, no matter how we live our life, there will be some bad news. Life is not only bad news. There's good news in it. There's boredom. There's fun. There's all kinds of experiences. But you're going to get what's known as dukkha in there. You're going to get real tough experiences. You're going to, no matter how you live your life, you're going to grow old. You're going to experience sickness, death. You're going to experience loss, rejection, abandonment, disappointments, not getting what you want, getting what you don't want, being with people you don't like, not being with people you really like. It's going to happen. You can't escape it. There's no way around it. So this is the first arrow that life shoots into us. And there's, the Buddha said that there's very little we can do about those first arrows. In fact, there's nothing we can really do about it. It's just what happens in life. There's nothing personal about it. Everybody gets the same rude treatment by being born. So, and yet, though, once we've been shot with this first arrow, we turn around, the Buddha said, and we shoot ourselves with the second arrow. And he goes on in the numbered discourses to sort of flesh out, what is this second arrow we shoot ourselves with? Well, he said there's two things that happen when we experience a setback, a real series of bad news. The first thing we do, he said, is we add the completely unnecessary papancha, or proliferation of thought. And we do this in terms of, why me? Why the fuck is this happening to me? Something is wrong. Holy shit, the universe is ganging up on me. This is not fair. All of these statements are wildly inaccurate because suffering and bad news happens to everyone. It's universal, transpersonal. There's nothing particularly mine about the setbacks I've had in life. It feels at the time like it's very much about me, that it's very much a personal insult when, you know, the bad news happens. We like to think that there are examples of people like Madonna on TV who seem to have gilded lives where there's no suffering, but I guarantee you, there's suffering in everybody's life. So, we add this sense that it's personal, that it's, that we're alone, that we've done something wrong, that something's amiss. And this papancha, this proliferation of thought, taking it personally, adding a whole narrative to it, creates a second response, which the Buddha says is we look around for a way to get rid of whatever is going on as quickly as possible. For some people, that's addiction. We want to get drunk so we're not aware. We're not feeling the sadness, the disappointment, the loss, the grief, the confusion. We if the prapancha gets bad enough that it even overwhelms the initial arrow of, oh my God, this is terrible, I've lost my job, or I'm going through a divorce, or whatever, if sometimes the whole, you know, how dare they, this is unfair, I'm being mistreated, these thoughts can recycle so much that the suffering, the underlying stress becomes so great that we really need to get rid of the entire experience as quickly as possible. And what we wind up doing through this reactivity is we make things worse. We become even more defensive, bent out of shape, stressed out. We wind up running away and hiding and isolating, or acting like bulldozers and stomping our feet and creating scenes, or we simply fall down and numb ourselves in our addictions, or we do any number of unskillful things that not only make the conditions worse by acting unskillfully, we prolong it. We add more and more and more unskillfulness and drama into our lives, and then what happens is it becomes even more challenging and more overwhelming. So rather than being a tool that helps us, our immediate ingrained habitual reactions, which are generally fight, flight, or freeze, are not in fact dealing or coping with the situation or the underlying feelings, even more importantly, the felt feelings of sadness. What we wind up doing is searching for distractions or diversions or anything that will make the overwhelming situation seem to go away. How many people, when they have had bills to pay, wind up shopping more? How many people, when they have papers to write, wind up watching TV shows they've already seen before? How many of us, when I've known men who have gotten into real serious trouble with a relationship through infidelity, and the way they deal with it is by being even more infidelitous. Walked my way into a word where an adjective that didn't exist. What? Disloyal.
Promiscuous.
Now, is that what women are all coming up with? Men are like, is there even a word? So you get it. Our reactions to stress almost invariably make things worse. Because our reactions are ingrained when we're very, very young, when we're children. That's where they are ingrained. That's when we form our reactive coping strategies. And they stick. So anything we do a lot sticks into the mind. So if we, you know, stomp our feet and scream and whine and become overdramatic when bad things happen, then that's what we'll do. Or if we run away and hide and throw the covers over our head, that's what we'll do. Or if we blame everyone around us, that's what we'll do. Because we've ingrained those coping strategies. So the core of Buddhist practice has often been referred to as preparing for dukkha, preparing for loss and suffering and disappointment. Some even say a lot of Buddhist practice is preparing for death itself. So how, or we'll start with the idea of preparing. If you've ever been in a fire drill, I've been in fire drills, and I was for a long time the person that just made fun of the people doing the fire drill and just totally didn't pay attention just seemed completely absurd. And then I was in a real fire. And there's smoke everywhere. And literally, you can't see an inch in front of your face. And you have no idea where you are. And no idea what to do. And if it wasn't for the fact that I had actually, even as a snarky, you know, college student, if I hadn't have gone through that drill, I would have fucking been trapped. But because I had walked through the drill, I had ingrained neurally the movements of where to turn and how to get to the fire, the staircase, and how to go down. Preparations are basically ingraining into the basal ganglia, the deep part of the brain that can record our movements and set our habits. It's literally placing in the mind a solution that will hopefully be there when we're in an emergency, when we're really fucked up and we're really stressed out and we don't know what to do. We'll have something implanted. They say that airline pilots spend more than half of their time preparing for events that will never, ever occur. Ever. But they want them to have had the hand movements in place so that in the unlikely event that there's a loss of cabin pressure and the two engines go out and the bird hits, I don't know what the fuck I'm talking about, but that they'll know what they'll have already gone through the movements. If you wait until an emergency arises to figure out what to do, you're fucked. That's the Buddhist term. You're fucked. Why is it? Well, because when you're in an emergency, you're stressed out. You're beginning to hyperventilate. The muscles are getting tense. Your mind is contracting around the fear source. The thoughts are spiraling out of control, and the only thoughts you have are the ones that are the ingrained survival at all costs, get rid of the situation. And people very often do the exact wrong thing unless they've had ingrained practice to do the thing that's useful. Sometimes people will steer when they're in the car is in a free skid, they'll try to steer out of it completely the wrong way and go off of cliffs because they haven't had the training of how to steer out of a skid. Sometimes when people are caught in a riptide, they'll try to swim back to shore unless they've had somebody again and again remind them and plant the thought of no, swim parallel to the shore until you get out of the riptide. You get the idea. That the survival-based immediate response is almost invariably, how can I get rid of this? One example that Tara Brach uses from the book The Right Stuff is, for a long time before Chuck Yeats, when they were having these planes that flew really high, when they re-entered gravity, they go through a tailspin. And the pilots would try to steer themselves out of it. And all of them crashed. And Chuck Yeager was the first pilot that came up with a solution. What his solution was, when he came back in and the plane went into a tailspin, he knocked his head and he lost consciousness. And the plane righted itself. He didn't do anything. When he came to, the instruments returned to correct readings. And he could fly the plane out. And that became the procedure. Do nothing. But that is so against the grain of our ingrained, oh my God, I'm in a tailspin, I've got to take control, and I've got to get myself out of this. So we almost invariably want to do the first thing that comes into our mind, and it's almost invariably unskillful because it's something that's been implanted when we were 5 years old, and that doesn't work when we're adults. So what are the ways that the Buddha prepares us for the emergencies in life? What are these tools that we're doing? So the core of the first set of three tools is based on pausing, not reacting, not immediately needing to do something, but how do we get a grip, reduce the amount of inner papancha and fear and stress that's arising in the body and the mind, so that we can then, in the second step, so 3, 4, 5, and 6, the second set of three tools, we can take action. So, the first tool is what's known as kaya gata sati, which means when we are overwhelmed and when we're in a really difficult, tight spot, the first thing to do is to note the body, to scan the body, see where the fear is, and relax it. Now, we prepare for this in life by not waiting until emergencies happen. Throughout the course of our day, we practice what's known as mindfulness. In the mindfulness routine, it's known as Vedana Sati, which means awareness of the body and the stresses it holds. We all hold so much of our fear and our anger and our anxiety and our worry in the body. When we're about to do something that's really unskillful, the dominant feature that's pushing us to say something horrible, to shout at someone, to strike, to run, to hide, is the body. It's not the mind, it's the body. The body becomes so tight, so uncomfortable, that we are literally pushing ourselves through discomfort to act. So if we want to attain any calmness, any perspective, any grounding before we act, what we do is we first find the sensations where we carry the fear, and we, as much as we can, we release these areas. It could be the muscles that attach to the neck to the shoulders. It could be the stomach muscles that literally cramp in the stomach. It could be the chest which collapses. It could be the jaw which slams up against the teeth, or the forehead which gets tightened. You get the idea. You have to learn your own body and where you carry your stress. Now, it's important to note that some of the feelings we have during catastrophes are important not to get rid of. These are the feelings of sadness and disappointment, the deeper feelings. And I guarantee you they'll be there too, but they won't be the dominant feelings that are carried in the body when you're in a panic, when you're overwhelmed. Those will be the feelings of there's something wrong, I've got to act. And those are the tight clenching. The feelings of loss and sadness that happen when we're facing a great loss in our life, they're more hollow, a hollow feeling in the chest, a hollow feeling in the throat. So you'll begin to notice the difference between the two. But in general, anything you're feeling in the body during a really stressful event will be the sensations of panic, stress, and those will be the ones that we want to relax. So we, throughout the course of our lives, even when we're not in a calamity, we practice doing this, just like pilots practice for, you know, things that might not ever happen. We practice as we walk through the course of our day, before we go into a meeting, we practice scanning the body, relaxing it. In the morning, when we're in the shower, we scan. When we're waiting for a subway train, there's nothing to do, scan the body. See where the impatience is for the train to arrive. When we're going into a meeting at work or with somebody that we're not looking forward to, a roommate, and there's a feeling of, oh, this is not going to go anywhere, where does that feeling of this is not going to turn out well, where does it reside in the body? Find it. Learn your body, and then learn how to invite this area to relax. The second tool is anapanasati, very related. It's simply find the breath. Notice if the breath is long, if you're not shortening the exhalations. When we are in a panic spiral or overwhelmed, I guarantee you the breath will be shallow, it won't be moving the chest, and B, you'll be shortening the exhalations. When we're hurrying and racing and panicked, the exhalations are very, very, very shortened, and there's no pause between the breaths. We go into a sort of a verging on a hyperventilation. So you want to find the breath and make sure the exhalations are very long and the in-breath deep enough that it's moving the chest. Very important that it moves the chest. That starts to trigger the release of serotonin and de-trigger the release of cortisol. So those are the first two. The third is what the Buddha called nekama, and that means letting go. What are we letting go of? We let go of every single story, narrative, obligation, responsibility, anything that is not immediately right now appropriate to be addressing. The reason why difficulties in life can suddenly be blown into absolute tragedies and absolute unbearable situations is often because we carry around such busy stories about how many different things we have to accomplish in our life. We have to pay back our loans. We have to show up for relationships. We have to be creative. We have to maintain good standing in our job. We have to go to our 12-step meetings. We have to go to our spin class, you know. And so when something happens, it seems to throw not just that, the relationship, up in the air, it throws everything up in the air. Oh my God, I don't have enough money. I won't be able to pay the rent. I won't be able to go to my exercise. I won't be able to do this. I won't be able to. And because we have all these dramas we're carrying around, we become overwhelmed. So the key with letting go is focusing on right now in front of me, what is the thing that is most important for me, and I'm going to throw aside everything else. I have to be able to prioritize. It's a little bit like a famous story of Ajahn, I believe it's Ajahn Fuang, but I'm not sure, I'll have to look it up. Ajahn Fuang was meeting his students for a retreat at a railway station. And his students, apparently, some of them were wealthy, and they brought all these bags and bags of stuff. They wanted to bring their entire lives with them on this week-long retreat. So they brought all this stuff. And when the monk saw this, he said, okay, let's start walking. And they were like, walking? We're at the... So he walked along the train tracks. He didn't go on the train. And they all followed him with their luggage. And one by one, over the course of the miles they walked, they had to drop one piece after another, until they just kept the most essential thing that they needed. And through that, he began the process of helping them prioritize what's really important and what you don't need to carry with you. It was a lesson. How do you know what's important? Well, ask yourself right now, or whenever it's convenient, when you look back on the course of your life, say you're on your deathbed, fun thought, you're on your deathbed, what will you look back and think's most important? What will you be most proud of? Just get to know that. What will you cherish? Is it your creative life? Is it your love that you give to your friends? It won't be your job. Nobody, I've done work with the dying, and I've never heard somebody say, oh, if only I climbed a little higher in that career ladder, I would feel good right now. Never heard that. I have heard, oh, if only I loved or expressed my love for my family a little more. So you prioritize what's important, and you know that, and then when the calamity hits, you take care of that area. And you let everything else fall apart if it's necessary. You let your job fall apart. You let your, you know, exercise fall apart. Whatever. Whatever of those the most important things you take care of, whatever is right there in front of you that you can address, you take care of. But the ability to clear out the mind of all the stories that we carry around, this is essential, and this is what we do when we meditate. This is what we're practicing. We're practicing focusing the mind on what's important right now. When you focus the mind, you become aware that it's generally, things are much less dramatic than you ever imagined. Because when you look right now, what's happening right here, there's very often little going on. All right, so those are the first three, and they're about pausing. The second three are the refuges, and they are the tools and the abodes that give us a source of wisdom on how to proceed. The first refuge is just asking yourself, in terms of Buddha Sangam, Buddha non Sangam, which is basic Buddha non Saranam. It's basically asking yourself, when we're in a difficult situation, when we're in a bind, when we're overwhelmed, what would somebody who doesn't experience fear right now do? That's basically the Buddha's great example. He showed us what somebody who doesn't experience fear or craving or self-centered survival at all costs. Just ask ourselves, what would somebody in this situation who wasn't terrified, what would they do? It's good to know somebody in our life that we hold up or we can see as somebody who acts despite fear and who is brave. Someone who, not brave in terms of stupid brave, but brave in terms of taking, doing things that stretch themselves and greet challenges. When you have somebody that you know, that you've seen, who's greeted challenges and difficulties and embraced them, or at least worked with them without resorting to panic, you can visualize this person. Ask yourself, how would they proceed? It's really important to have somebody in mind that you can call to mind. Almost imagine them being right with you so you don't feel alone, and you can have this person there that will basically give you guidance. This is a very much a practice often used in meditation, where we visualize a teacher and we wish them happiness. We visualize somebody who's been a source of strength for us, or somebody who's exemplified patience. It's really good to have this in mind, because if you don't know what anybody would do when they're not fearful, it will be difficult to proceed. So that's refuge in the Buddha, or the example of the spirit of the Buddha. Could somebody just turn on the light a little bit? I feel like I'm in prehistoric times now, and there should be like a cave behind me. There we go. The next is the Dhamma, which means simply have in mind a teaching that you've kept in mind that will pop into your mind as an alternative to your normal way of thinking when you become overwhelmed with stress and fear. With a lot of people, they use the metta meditation, simply reciting daily, may I be truly peaceful, may I find a way to be at ease no matter what arises. May I remember the true peace comes from within. May I wish true peace from all beings. May I appreciate the happiness of others. These types of phrases, if we repeat them enough on a daily basis, when we are in panic, they actually have a chance of arising, rather than the, oh my God, I'm going to lose it. I'm going to fall apart. Oh my God, it's all coming to a crumble. And a crumble is not a word, by the way. So anyway, it's all coming to a crumble. My God. I was on a ski lift, and I have a terrible fear of heights. I had no idea that it was going to be like one of those rickety things where there's just a bar separating you, you know, from impaled death below, and you know, looking hundreds of feet down at the tops of trees. And I was like, I felt the fear rising in my throat, and I relaxed it. But the thoughts of, oh my God, you know, what if you What if you get blown off by a gust of wind? What if an act of craziness, you jump off, you know? And thankfully, there was that little thought of, may I be peaceful? And I'm like, I'm going with you. I'm going with you. And I just focused repeating, may I be peaceful, may I be free of stress. And I just focused on it, and the breath began to relax, and so did the body. One of the phrases I use is from the teaching of Radhapala, which is a summary of the Buddha's Dharma. And it goes, the world will be swept away. Nothing endures. There is no shelter. No one is in charge. There is nothing we own. We leave it all behind. The world itself is not enough to fill my craving. I know that by heart, but I don't use that version. I just use my simplified one, which is, it's all going to fucking pass. It's all going to pass. And because it's all going to pass, the solution is not out there. It's inside. So I repeat that. And so very often when I'm overwhelmed, I feel I've got too many things pulling at me, I don't know where to turn, I feel financially adrift or whatever, I remind myself that the idea that the solution was always was out there is the problem, that the answer, the security, the lasting peace is within, that everything out there is going to change, even the bad news. It all changes. I don't necessarily, when I'm undergoing a really difficult time, I don't believe always that things will externally get better. So I never say to myself, oh, this will get better. Because I don't believe that. But I have seen in my life that no matter what I'm experiencing, things change. Situations change. So knowing that whatever I'm facing today, 6 months from now will be an entirely different struggle, an entirely different challenge, that brings a great deal of detachment and peace. So I have those dharmas implanted in my mind so that when the fear of, oh, it's all coming to an end, I really blew it, I suck, I have this other voice in there that's implanted through repetition. The last tool is Sangam Saranam, which is basically look around you. Lots of people here. When you're in the Sangha, try at least at the beginning or at the end just to say hello to somebody. Ask them how they're doing or talk about what you're going through. Use this place as an opportunity to develop a support group or at least a support friend. The more we have people that we can share the burdens and the challenges of life, the less alone we feel. And when we feel less alone and unique, the overwhelming quality of a challenge becomes to diminish greatly. Because it's the fear of being alone that makes us feel vulnerable. But when we find out that everybody has gotten fired, dumped from a relationship with no reason, everybody's gone through a financial crisis, everybody has been in long-term unemployment at a point, everybody has faced challenges. They might be different slightly, but the core feelings are certainly all the same. The fear, the overwhelmedness, the loneliness, the confusion. When we realize this, we feel so much less alone. When we don't feel alone, we can act with a great deal more patience and courage than we ever imagined. So that's all I'm going to blather on about. I hope you got something from there. I hope there was some wisdom tucked amidst all the verbiage. I thank you for listening, and now I'm going to turn